This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. That's Dmitri Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, Leningrad, performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. That part of the movement is from the first movement. Soon there will be an invasion, the strings and the drums leading the way with the woodwinds and brass joining in the march. This symphony, when it debuted in the early 1940s, came to symbolize the Nazi invasion of Russia and the siege of the country's city, Leningrad. Shostakovich was lauded as a patriot who stirred the hearts not just of Russians, but of Americans and Europeans. But questions remained about the composer's motivations and what invasion he was actually depicting, Hitler's or Stalin's. Many questions about Shostakovich's motivations remain unanswered, but in his new book, Vermont author M.T. Anderson explores the man and the political and cultural atmosphere that he created his famous music in. The book is called Symphony for the City of the Dead, and it's in some ways a departure for Anderson, who's known for his young adult fiction, but some of the themes in this new book are eerily reminiscent of his other books, notably Feed, which is set in a future where we have technology implanted directly into our brains to give us banner ads, shopping suggestions, and information that doesn't even require the swipe of a finger. That, perhaps, is not the same as Shostakovich's Russia, but some of the questions about the way the government behaves are very similar. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to explore the world of M.T. Anderson. Welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be here.
So you're not actually somebody who's been in Vermont forever. How did you get here?
Well, I actually, I really have always loved the state. My parents and I used to come up for vacations and things. But then I got a job at Vermont College of the Fine Arts. And I just love the Montpelier area. And so now I live here.
And you feel like you can write here and do all the research that you need to do?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even though I was doing the research for this book about Soviet Russia, I mean, some of it was done in St. Petersburg or, you know, in the National Archives in Moscow. Oddly enough, I ended up doing some of it right here in Vermont as well, you know. And you know, Vermont College of the Fine Arts, I use the library there, and they can, at this point in history, you can get things from sort of anywhere in the world, regardless of where you are, because of technological change. So, yeah, absolutely.
What is your approach to writing for young people? Because most of your books are, most of them are sort of for teenagers or young adults, although some are for even younger readers. But you have this approach that doesn't, you don't shy away from tough language, you don't shy away from tough things that have happened in history in this latest book. So what's your approach to writing for young people?
Well, I mean, I think that when I was a kid, my overwhelming feeling was that I switched to books for adults as quickly as possible because I felt like, I don't want to have someone sort of like talking down to me, patting me on the head. I want to deal with real issues and, you know, with a real sophistication. And I think kids want to be sophisticated in many ways. And so I am trying when I write to write for the kid I was and, you know, and my friends in a sense at that age and to say, look, the world is going to be yours. It's going to belong to you. This is what a complex and fascinating place it is. That's kind of my philosophy about it.
When parents write to you, do they say, that's all great, but could you please use the F word a little bit less frequently?
Well, you know, incidentally, the F word never appears once in this book.
That's true.
But I mean, the deaths of some 35 million people senselessly do. But, you know, I think in the case of Feed, which actually does use profanity, that is a book which is about a future where language is decaying. And it is absolutely central to the idea of that book that no one can really express themselves well anymore. So when I wrote it, my editor said to me, you know that if you use this language, it's going to be kept out of certain schools. And I said, well, that's fine because in a sense, I have to confront the idea of how language deteriorates. And that was part of it.
And have you heard about schools that won't take it because of the language in it?
Yeah. It was banned in Iowa, for example, and they claimed that there was sexual material in it. I pointed out that all the sex in the book is bad sex, but I guess bad sex was still too good for Iowa. I don't know.
There isn't really much.
No, there is not. No. No, it's mainly a satire of kind of consumerism and of the monstrous thing that, sort of internet advertising has become in all of our lives and all these forms of advertising that infiltrate, any kind of narrative, television, movies, all that kind of thing nowadays.
We're talking with M.T. Anderson. He's just written a big, bold new book about the life of Dmitri Shostakovich. The Russian composer played a large role in World War II, despite not being a soldier. His Seventh Symphony, the Leningrad Symphony, was propaganda, protest, and an expression of the will to live, triumphing over deprivation, starvation, and depression. It's a remarkable true story, but it has some interesting echoes to his earlier novel, the one that we were just talking about, which is set in the future, Feed. We're talking about all of his work today and his approach to capturing the interest of the teenage mind. And I know many of you who either aren't teenagers but read the works or have teenagers who have also read M.T. Anderson have a lot to share with us as well. So if you have a question for the author or you want to share your thoughts with us, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note for us on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You know, you were just talking about schools, and we actually got a note from Dorianne who said, a few years ago, ninth graders at People's Academy High School in Morrisville had the incredible privilege of a discussion with M.T. Anderson. He's a brilliant writer, and his works are a fantastic addition to the world of young adult and even adult literature. The novel Feed has been a staple of the ninth grade curriculum for several years here as we introduce discussions of digital footprints, digital citizenship, and the digital world's impact on our own identity. Along with Feed, students read the speech On the Intelligence of Teens, found in Anderson's website, as well as Plato's Allegory of the Cave. At the moment, our students are working on putting all of these ideas together. They came up with a few questions to ask, some about Feed and some about the writing process in general. So I'm going to share with you their questions.
That's
for you.
Great.
Okay, so one of the questions is, how do you know when an idea is worth pursuing through a book?
I think just because I become passionate about it. I mean, in the case of, say, Feed, the idea was, even as a teenager, before we had any of the technology that we have now, I still felt like I had the voice of advertising in my head installed there already. You know what I mean? I didn't need a chip there because already there was always a voice when I was a teenager. And we're talking about the late 80s, you know, a voice saying to me, you know, if you buy this, you'll be popular. If you buy this, you'll be loved. Come on. Be one of the gang. And so I feel like that experience was what I was writing about symbolically in the book in a wider sense. The technology, in a sense, especially when I was writing it, which was a long time ago, back in 2001, the technology just was kind of like a science fiction joke to me. I had no idea that we would move so quickly towards what I was describing.
Well, and that, I mean, so in Feed, you basically, most people or anybody with enough money, which is most of the middle class and anybody above that, has this technology implanted directly into their body. And as we find out in the book, it really sort of infiltrates your entire body and helps control your whole limbic system and how your brain functions. But it's installed in there, and then you don't have to think about whether you want to click on your phone to find information or to find the latest movie or to find out what styles are in vogue. The feed will tell you that stuff. And it's sort of like Wikipedia on steroids. You don't ever have to question anything. You can just look up something in your brain, basically.
Right. Or like a Google search, in the sense that it starts to recognize what it is that you tend to like. And so it sends you messages immediately about that.
One of the other questions from People's Academy is, how did you predict that future? Did you know you were predicting it? Because you say you had no idea it would.
No, I thought it was a possibility. But no, I mean, I was writing about the kind of consumer commercialism that already existed. I was writing about how it existed for me back in 2001 and in 1985, you know.
Were you really aware of that stuff when you were a teenager? I mean, I can remember, and I was a teenager in the mid to late 90s, well, in the mid 90s. I can remember the moment where it first came to me that, oh my gosh, people are trying to give me messages through advertising, which maybe I was naive. But, you know, we had a class on Naomi Wolf and beauty. And so you had these ideas about beauty, and they all came from the media, you know, the horrible media. So I can remember somebody opening my eyes to that. But it sounds like you sort of had a sense of that even when you were a young person with nobody giving you that information.
Well, because I think that it impacts the way that we see ourselves so profoundly. So I was a really unprepossessing looking teenager. I was incredibly thin. I looked kind of like a tetherball setup. You know what I mean? And I always therefore had this sense that that I did not appear the way that I should appear, that I was deficient in some way, that I was, I mean, you know, the feelings are so intense when you're a teenager, and the feelings of wanting to belong and what it feels like to not be able to belong. And I could tell that the images I was being shown were part of that. And in fact, I'm actually glad that I was a teenager then, only for the rather bizarre and twisted reason that boys have actually gotten more, there's been more of a push since around 2000 for boys to have a particular kind of physique and that kind of thing than was true in the 1980s. In the 1980s, we kind of got the gender pass, as it were, a little bit more. Whereas, you know, starting around 2000, there was that sudden emphasis on, you know, boys looking kind of like ripped, and you're having all these commercials with, you know, kids without shirts on so you can show all their abs, that kind of thing. And I already felt bad enough without that.
One more question from the People's Academy kids who wonder, why would you portray teenagers so negatively in Feed when you actually think so highly of their intelligence, passion, and abilities?
Oh, well, I don't depict all of them negatively. I mean, the other thing is the adults in that society are swept up by it as teens. And I think it's good to point out that, for example, insofar as the book is about things like social media, in many cases, it's people of my generation and even older, even my parents' generation, who are very involved with that now. It's not, I mean, who's using Facebook? It's no longer as much a teen vehicle at all. You know what I mean? It's a lot of it is people of my age and older. So everyone is involved in this system, every one of us. And in many ways, teens, because they're younger, there's still a chance for them to see around it, to not accept it as the world that has to be, but instead to say, look, there's another world hiding out there.
What I find so interesting in Feed, to go to that question, is not why do you portray teenagers so negatively? It's that teens and everybody else, but the only characters in the book are the teenagers for the most part. Parents are sort of out there a little bit. They make an occasional appearance, teachers. But it's that there's no choice. When you are faced with this overwhelming amount of technology and the information that you're being given is censored information, then it's really difficult to find anything other than the truth, in quotes, of what technology and the media is telling you. I mean, in Feed, even the schools are run by corporations. And at one point, one of your characters says, you know, kids used to have to learn about things like history and who did this, when, to whom, and what country was invaded. Thank God we don't have to learn that stuff anymore. So it's interesting that, you know, the kids in this book, a couple of them really are striving for some deeper truth, despite all of that technology that's in their brains telling them, don't pay attention to that, buy this new great thing.
Right. Well, and actually you can see the way, as you observe the internet now and since its founding, you can always see those kids who are actually getting around it, you know, who are using it against itself. Because all of the information you need to understand the world is actually out there. The question is just, who is going to lead it to you? How are you going to know it's there? How are you going to know that, you know, that, for example, the industrial processes that we rely on involve certain kinds of abuses or, you know, whatever it is. And the question is really finding it rather than whether it's there at all. So censorship in a way has changed. I mean, you talked earlier about this being a book about the government, but it isn't really. It's really about a corporate structure that surrounds the government.
It's
not about censorship. It's about actually cramming us all full of information that we can't notice what the important things are. So in Feed, for example, that world, as the reader will see, is clearly falling apart in all kinds of ways. People are getting weird lesions all over their bodies, but
you know, oxygen is being depleted.
Right. But at the same time, you know, no one's paying attention to that because there's so much else to look at. And so they just kind of like, you know, we're getting lesions on our body. Let's accessorize them.
Right. Let's make them a fashion statement.
Right.
So do you see parallels with the world today? Not so much as, wow, what I predicted has come true, in the way that, you know, now if you're on the computer, you'll see banner ads pop up when you're on social media that are showing things that, oh, gosh, how does it even know I want that? So Certainly that's happening. But when you look at the politics of today and our culture of today, I mean, we're heading into this big climate summit in Paris.
Right. And
so do you see these connections today? Do you feel despair that we're in the world that we're in?
Well, I do feel like we have to actually wake up. And we have to actually make a move on these things that are going to affect the lives of our children. And it should not be a partisan thing because, you know, children are bipartisan, you know what I mean? And they are going to have to deal with the world that we are creating now. And we can't afford to say, sure, science is right when it creates things like cell phones that we all rely on. But for some reason, science is wrong about the state in which the global climate is going.
I have one more question about feed, and then we're going to talk about other things, including this great new book, The Symphony for the City of the Dead, that you've just come out with. But I'm curious, in feed, there's a scene, and this is a little bit in the weeds, but I think it'll be understandable to people who haven't read it as well. There's a scene where, the feed will tell you what's in vogue, and so you go and you can change your fashion immediately because, oh my gosh, those jeans aren't in style anymore. This is the kind of clothing that you should be wearing. And some of the girls in the book suddenly are wearing very ripped clothing. It's sort of dirty, tattered, maybe even bloody, if I'm remembering correctly. And it's riot clothes, and they're designed to be reminiscent of history. And so they have these names like the Watts Collection or, oh, that's from the Kent State Collection. And I was curious about why you included that, because it's very clear in the book that the characters don't have any frame of reference for these moments in American history. But I'm wondering if you think teenagers today who read the book have that frame of reference, because, you know, I think my generation sort of does. Our parents were often involved or deeply moved by the 50s and 60s and what was happening in those certain periods. But I wonder about teens of today if you think they're learning that in American history.
Well, I mean, I think that that even if people don't know the specific names of the riots, they're aware of the late 60s as being a time of tremendous social upheaval, but also kind of a new positive awareness of the urgency of those issues. And certainly the thing is that I think that it's, you know, the riots that are happening now are very much in the public eye and are very much something that young people are concerned about, which is it's wonderful that they're concerned about it and that may mean that there will be change.
So you see it as a connection that even if they don't know about it, those words float through your head and maybe you look them up for the
right. Well, especially because I think that the context makes it pretty clear the kind of joke I'm making. So even if they don't know what the Watts riot what is or whatever, I think that they will. They'll get a sense of what that is.
Again, today we're talking with the author M.T. Anderson. We're talking about his created worlds. We're also going to talk about the real world that he writes about in Symphony for the City of the Dead. This is about Dmitri Shostakovich, the Russian composer, and his Leningrad Symphony. If you've read any M.T. Anderson and you'd like to share your thoughts, maybe like the students at People's Academy, you have questions for the author, or if you'd just like to share a thought with us, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or hey, use the social media we've got and post a note to us on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're joined by M.T. Anderson, who now lives mostly full-time here in Vermont. He's on the board of the Vermont College of Fine Arts, where he also used to teach. He's sharing with us his approach to writing for young adults and teens. He doesn't spare his readers the horror of war or the blue language of the common teenager, and he doesn't treat his readers like lesser readers just because they're young. His latest book is about Russian composer Dmitri Shostakovich. It's called Symphony for the City of the Dead, Dmitri Shostakovich and the Siege of Leningrad. If you have a question for him about writing nonfiction or about his earlier works like Feed, Whales on Stilts, or The Serpent Came to Gloucester, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. So your latest project is Symphony for the City of the Dead, and it's this beautiful, big, very dense, very thorough history of Dmitri Shostakovich, who's a Russian composer, and his particular point in history, what he represented to Russia and beyond. And I know you're going to read a little bit from the book, but you'd like to give us a little more information before you fill our heads with that beautiful language.
Yeah, well, I mean, the book is about this situation, which I heard about as a young man listening to this music, and I found it gripping as a story, which is that in the Siege of Leningrad, which is the longest siege that we know of in recorded human history, several years, this city was under siege by the Germans during World War II. And this is a city then, I mean, we're talking about northern Russia, but with no electricity, no very little food coming in at all. It's no running water anymore. Negative 20 inside people's apartments. Finally, in the very first winter, people actually turned to eating the corpses of the dead because there was no other food source. So the most stark situation imaginable. During this siege, at the beginning of this siege, the composer Dmitri Shostakovich was stuck there at first. He escaped, but he was stuck there for the beginning of this siege and actually wrote a symphony, the Leningrad Symphony, the Seventh Symphony. He wrote a lot of it while he was actually in that city. He was acting as a fireman on the roof of the conservatory, watching for incendiary bombs, and then he was also writing this piece. So it's about that, about him writing the piece, and then also I had heard this unbelievable story about the American story connected with this, which is that that piece was put onto microfilm and smuggled out, like flown to Tehran, driven through the deserts to Cairo, flown across northern Africa down to Brazil, and then finally up to the U.S. And here it was actually produced, broadcast on NBC for an audience of millions. And the idea was people wanted to get the Americans interested in the Soviet cause. Up until about a year before, we had not been their ally. They had been viewed with great suspicion. So this was a way to convince people the Russians are fighting the same enemy. They are on our side. Their tribulations are something that we should pay attention to. And then the final story about this, the third and final story that really had caught my attention was the fact that then this piece was actually played in Leningrad itself, in besieged Leningrad. So they went around finding musicians who were starving to death. They would knock on doors. They found these musicians who were starving to death, and they brought them together for this performance of this piece in summer of 1942. And the night that they performed it, they actually bombed the Germans. The Red Army bombed the Germans on the far side of the city so that the German fire would be drawn away from the concert hall. And they performed this piece, and they broadcast it through all the streets of the city. They broadcast it in people's apartments and across no man's land towards the Germans as a sign to the Germans, no matter what you do to us, you cannot make our humanity fail. And in fact, years later, the conductor of the symphony that night ran into some German tourists, and they said to him, "Look, we were actually soldiers on the other side. We were sitting there listening to the piece that night. We heard the Leningrad Symphony." And they said, "The night we heard the Leningrad Symphony was the night we knew we would never take the city of Leningrad." And so to me, I was just, this is a story. I mean, I love just the thing about the microfilm containing not a secret submarine plan or something, but instead something which was a symphony. But also, I just love the story of the power of music to change history and to change the world. And that's what I wanted to write about.
Can we listen to just a minute of that symphony so that we can have it in our heads as we continue this conversation? Here's a little bit of Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, Leningrad. So that's from the fourth and final movement of Dmitri Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, Leningrad. Boy, is it stirring. But the fourth movement, the final movement, doesn't wrap things up in this beautiful, bright bow of everything is joyous again. And so the symphony, which is supposed to sort of depict the siege of Leningrad and the attack, and then this final movement. What happens here, M.T. Anderson?
Well, I mean, there is a struggle still in the final movement. And it does, I mean, the part you played is really interesting. interesting part in that, you know, this is a piece that's huge. It's 76 minutes long. And there in the final minutes of the piece, which you literally were playing, you know, I mean, it was about 20 seconds from ending. In that section, you actually – he brings back the kind of the confident theme with which the symphony started, as if to say this is what life was like before the, you know, this disaster befell us, and we will be able to achieve this again. And what someone in the audience wrote in her diary, we do have like diary memoirs of what it was like to hear this thing. And it was an overwhelmingly powerful experience. But what one woman, for example, wrote was that she had heard in the symphony things that sounded like the approach of the Germans and the German assault. But that the symphony ended with victory, but it was a victory she felt that was still to come. That was a victory that they had not had yet. Now, one of the interesting things is that many people who survived the siege remember this moment of this being performed as a pivotal moment in the history of the siege. And it was emotionally, but oddly enough, when we look back on it, we see it wasn't necessarily tactically a big moment, but it was a moment at which Leningraders started to realize, wait a second, we are not subhuman in the way that our enemy is describing us. We are not merely the people who are grubbing in the dirt to try to pull up every root to eat. We are also a people with a proud history, and we are people who want to endure as humans despite all of the possibility of having to sort of behave almost animalistically to survive. So it was really important for them to understand themselves as heroes because, for example, the rest of Russia was not even allowed to know that they were starving to death. When people from Leningrad went and appeared on the radio, as I'm doing now, in the rest of the country, the party would say to them, do not speak of the starvation there because we can't let people know how bad conditions are in Leningrad. So the Leningraders, in a sense, this was a way for their story to be told. It was tremendously important to them.
You know, you have a lot about this symphony and that moment and what it meant as you said, not just in Russia and in Leningrad, but beyond and to the American cause and trying to get Americans sort of on board with siding with Russia and giving aid to Russia in return for nothing, which was a huge problem that the Americans had. But you also write about Shostakovich's life and what an complicated and interesting life he had. I mean, he was denounced by the government before this and after this symphony,
right.
But this symphony right. was this sort of patriotic moment. He was a hero of Russia, even within the government, even though, you know, at various times before and after, he was seen as an enemy of the people. He was anti-people.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, in the 1930s, in 1936, literally people would announce his concerts by saying, you know, we will have a concert now by enemy of the people, Dmitri Shostakovich. Probably not very well attended. That was during the Great Terror, where Shostakovich unfortunately found himself as the unwilling poster boy of what the government was calling formalism, which would be kind of like wicked bourgeois kind of artistic elitism, I guess you could call it. And so he was really pounded in that period, and members of his family were arrested, and some of them died in prison camps. His friends were arrested and tortured and executed for crimes that they had not committed. It was a terrifying time for him, the late 1930s. And yet, here he was suddenly put into this position of trying to defend the same government that had tortured his friends and members of his family. And it was an incredibly wrenching experience for him.
You know, when I was getting to know this book, I actually listened to the audio book instead of reading it page by page. And you read the audio book, which is really a wonderful experience to have your voice in my head, the voice of the author, as I was listening to this. And you also get a little bit of music with it, little snippets here and there that help inform you. And there's an event coming up at Bear Pond or from with Bear Pond Books, but in Montpelier on December 8th, that's actually going to incorporate your words and reading and music. Do you want to mention it?
Yeah, it's going to be on the 8th. It's going to be up at Vermont College of Fine Arts in the gallery there. And a quartet largely drawn from the Vermont Symphony Orchestra is going to play his 8-string quartet. And then I will talk about sort of like what are the codes in that piece? What are the messages in that piece? How can we understand it?
Yeah, because in fact, Shostakovich, at least as you write in the book, was often coding messages throughout his music. And that was one of the things that was very largely discussed about him, is what he actually meant in this
and
music.
And we still argue about it today, which is really interesting.
That's M.T. Anderson. He's the author of many books for young adults. His latest book is a nonfiction book for young adults and older. It's called Symphony for the City of the Dead, Dmitri Shostakovich and the Siege of Leningrad. Thank you so much for talking with us. I wish we had more time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Coming up, getting a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes often leaves people shocked, depressed, and overwhelmed. We'll be talking with the author of a book that aims to help the newly diagnosed navigate that difficult first year. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Gretchen Becker lives in Halifax, Vermont. She's a science writer, and in 1996, she was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. One of the ways she has coped with the disease is by researching and writing about it. She's just released a newly revised and updated edition of her book, The First Year, Type 2 Diabetes, An Essential Guide for the Newly Diagnosed.
There's so much to know about diabetes, and there wasn't really a book that said everything to me. So I wanted to write it.
What did you feel like when you first got the diagnosis?
I was in shock. I think everybody is in shock. Even if the diabetes is in your family and your parents both have it, you know you're going to get it. It's always like, well, in the future, not now.
And so for you, did you try to reach out and find this book that you've now written?
Well, I went on the internet and found other patients, and many of us have found that's the most useful thing. For one thing, they have a lot of experience. Doctors have the medical knowledge, but they don't have the day-to-day living with diabetes knowledge, and other patients do.
And so this book is designed to be that other patient for you, sort of to be that friend who helps you get through that initial diagnosis.
Right, and also go beyond it. I had a science background, so I found the science very interesting. So I learned a lot, and I was explaining the science behind it on an email list. That's how I got to know a lot of people.
So can you back up, Gretchen, and just remind people what type 2 diabetes is and how it's different from other forms of the disease?
There are a lot of different kinds of diabetes. The two main ones are type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is autoimmune, and that means that for some reason that nobody understands yet, your immune system attacks your pancreas, and the cells in the pancreas, they're called beta cells, that produce insulin. Type 2 has traditionally been thought of as being caused by insulin resistance, meaning you're producing a lot of insulin, but your body is resistant to it. Recently, they're beginning to change the idea of type 2 because they found that it's actually, in most people, it's not just that you have insulin resistance, it's that your pancreas can't produce enough insulin to overcome that insulin resistance. And they're even discovering some people with type 2 have those autoantibodies that type 1s do too.
And remind people the connection between insulin and sugar. For a lot of people who don't have diabetes or don't have a family member with diabetes, you just think, sugar, something about sugar.
You need insulin so that most of the cells in your body can take up sugar. It's like a gatekeeper in your cells. There are a few cells, like the cells in your blood vessels, that don't need insulin, but most cells, especially muscle, fat, do need insulin. So without insulin, your cells will basically starve.
Gretchen, it's interesting. Not all books about diagnoses would have to start with a first chapter that says, day one, living, it's not your fault. So what is it about type 2 diabetes, and how do you address that, this idea that not only patients have, but is often out there in the world, that people who have type 2 diabetes brought it on themselves?
Right. That's a common misconception. The idea was that you let yourself get fat, as though anyone, you know, really wants to be fat. And the fat causes insulin resistance, and the insulin resistance causes diabetes. It's true that being overweight increases your insulin resistance, but there's a strong genetic component too, and in both obesity and in diabetes. So there are a lot of, not a lot, but some fat people that are very insulin sensitive. So if you have insulin resistance when you put on weight, it's because you have genes that do that. So in that sense, it's not your fault. When I say it's not your fault, I don't mean you can't do anything about it, because you can. A lot of people, losing weight really helps, but it's not your fault in the sense that you brought it on yourself.
That's one of the other things that's interesting about this disease, and that you point out, is that in order to live a healthy life with diabetes, you have to have some sort of self-management and self-care, and you really have to be a part of the process to make sure that you're going to live a long, healthy life with this disease.
Exactly. In some ways, you can live a healthier life. One saying is, if you want to live a healthy life, get a chronic disease that makes you take care of yourself. And there's some truth to that, you know, because if you don't have any reason, you're going to keep doing all the bad things that everybody normally does.
What about for you? I mean, you write in the introduction to your book that you were diagnosed in 1996, and one of the first things you read, which was a terrible first thing to read, was that people often with type 2 diabetes had about 8 years to live. And that was a horrible thing for you to read. And that, in fact, you think you do lead a healthier life now than you did before you were diagnosed.
Yes, I do. And having that grim diagnosis, that grim prognosis, plus not wanting to get complications, I wouldn't have minded dropping dead as much as I would have minded going blind. And that's what made me stick to my diet. I'd been trying to lose weight for, I'd say, 30 years. And in the process, I'd put on 30 pounds because you go out to dinner and somebody says, oh, come on, one bite won't hurt you. So you have the dessert and then you go home and you feel guilty because you ate it. So you eat the whole pie, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of dieters react like that. But this time I said, okay, this is serious.
Does type 2 diabetes act differently or very differently in different people? Or is it pretty consistent with what you can expect and what's going to help?
There's probably a lot of subtypes of type 2 diabetes that we don't know yet. There was recently an interesting study from Weizmann Institute in Israel showing that the glycemic index, which is a measure of how much carbohydrates raise your blood sugar, is actually different for different people. And in some people, the same food makes their blood sugar go up, whereas another person, it makes it go down. It's very individual.
You also have a section in the book about depression. Why was that important for you to cover?
Because it is depressing to get diabetes. But I've never had serious depression. But just to be a little blue, I think, is normal. But a lot of people get serious depression. And it never lets up. It's not like you can take the weekend off. You know, it's always there.
What do people who don't have good insurance do?
They have problems. I mean, it's hard. And that's why, again, they have to learn as much as they can about the disease so they can figure out the cheapest way to treat it.
This book that you've just put out is revised and updated. Is there
Correct.
New medical information? I mean, you're not a doctor, but you take pains to say that, but you are researching all of the latest information.
There's a lot of new drugs, especially there's one called an SGLT2 inhibitor, which makes you secrete a lot of glucose in your urine, and that's new. There are bile acid sequestrants. There's a drug called bromocriptine. A lot of new drugs.
How do you research these? How do you find out about what people actually need to know?
On the internet. Since I live in the country, I don't have access to a good library, but these days the internet is actually better.
I understand that this is designed for people who are at the beginning of their diagnosis to understand, how am I going to live with this disease? So is there anything that people should know about second year and beyond, or is it all fairly well contained?
I think they should keep in touch with fellow patients so they don't slide back. It's very easy to think you're cured, so to speak. If you control your diet really carefully, you can have normal blood sugars. And then you think, oh, I'm cured. And then you say, well, I'll just have a piece of pie at Christmas. And then the next thing you know, it's a piece of pie at every holiday. And the next thing you know, it's a piece of pie every weekend. And all of this raises your blood sugar. And raising your blood sugar burns out your beta cells, the cells that produce insulin. So you end up worse than you were.
And for you, how are you doing?
Okay. Pretty good. I have good A1Cs. That's a measure of your average blood sugar level for the past approximately 3 months. And I'm not blind yet. As I said in the book, my major complication is 20 years after diagnosis, I look 20 years older.
Yeah, I'm sorry that nobody could find a cure for that. Well, Gretchen Becker, I'm glad to hear that. Congratulations. And I know it's a lot of hard work to keep yourself on a program that keeps you healthy. The First Year, Type 2 Diabetes, An Essential Guide for the Newly Diagnosed, is Gretchen Becker's book. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. You probably heard this episode of Vermont Edition on a radio broadcast, but we also know that several thousand of you listened to this hour on a podcast. And that, podcasting, is our topic on tomorrow's show. The medium of podcasting has exploded with new voices and topics and more ways of accessing great audio. We'll explore it all tomorrow, and we want to know, what are your favorite podcasts? Email Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us on the radio or on the podcast tomorrow. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.